Welcome, everyone. Good morning. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for choosing to be with us. This is the breakout session, Handling Conflict at Work. My name is Giovanna Zafina, and I'm here in lieu of Kate Cray. Kate and I work together at Commonwealth Financial Network. Commonwealth is a business solutions provider for advisory services firms so that they can better service their clients. We are so thrilled to be first-time sponsors at this year's Massachusetts Conference for Women. I am completely ecstatic, as you can tell. So my day job is managing the Wealth Management Platform Development Group, but my passion work is leading our female women's network. We started in 2011 with only 18 women. Today, we have over 250, which makes up more than 90% of our female population, which I'm very excited about. Thank you. Thank you. Our mission is to inspire, empower, and support the women within our Commonwealth community. And we do that by sharing knowledge, experience, and creating connections. That includes discussions around topics such as navigating conflict at work. So some of you may consider it awkward, uncomfortable, even simply people just try to avoid it. And there's actually people that try to seek it. That's not me. With us today is Amy Gallo and these panelists to help us demystify handling conflict at work and managing our intent with our impact. I am extremely honored to introduce Amy Gallo. She is an expert in conflict management, communication, emotional intelligence, and overall workplace dynamics. She strikes the perfect balance between introducing research with practical advice. She is an author, a co-author, an editor, a contributor to numerous books and publications, and she even gave us that guidebook on how to deal with conflict, which is an amazing read, and she will be signing after this session. Amy is also a co-host at the HBR's Women at Work podcast. If you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend it. Speaking of, I actually recently attended a live showing of it just a few weeks ago before I even knew I was doing this session, and Amy was talking on this very topic, and so after seeing her in action, I know today is going to be fantastic. So please help me in welcoming Amy Gallo.
That was a really nice introduction. Thank you. So I have a theory. This room is packed, and I have a theory about why you all might be here. So do me a favor. Think for a moment about the most recent conflict you had at work. Maybe it was with your boss. Maybe it was with a peer. Maybe it was with a direct report. And tell me, just raise of hands, how many people would say they tried their best to avoid that conflict? Yeah. And how many people say Giovanna used the word seek. How many people went right in, dug right in? That's a good number of you. All right, good. So my theory is that most of us, especially women, really would prefer conflict never existed. And in fact, I often get asked to speak at organizations and they say, we love your topic. Could you actually just not use the word conflict? Which is actually impossible, so I say no. But most of us do tend to avoid conflict, and that is because conflict can feel like a threat. And when we feel threatened, whether we are afraid of losing our identity, our job, our resources, our sense of self, we go into what Dan Goleman calls amygdala hijack, where the feeling part of our brain takes over, and we lose access to the prefrontal cortex. So we don't make good decisions. We go into what many of you probably know as fight or flight. Right? And that is not a good place to approach a difficult conversation. To handle conflict at work in that state is just not good. So I'm going to talk just for a few minutes about how do you get yourself out of that amygdala hijack so you can actually have the conversation. And then we're going to talk with our wonderful panelists about how do you actually handle the conflict once hopefully you've calmed down some. So there, in my book, I talk about four steps that you want to do before you even have the conversation. Now, I describe these as if you have all the time in the world, right? As if someone, you know, says something awful about your project in a meeting and you can say, please hold, I'm going to go back to my desk, I'm going to analyze this conflict for 2 hours, and then I'll come back with a response, right? Luckily, most of these steps are things we can do very quickly in our head. There's things that really, with practice, eventually you should be able to do within 30 seconds. And sometimes you choose, I have my favorites, which I will answer if people want to know what those are. But sometimes you just need to do one or two of them in that moment. But let me talk you through the four. The very first thing, and I promise you this will be the last thing you want to do in the moment, is that you have to think about the other person. We are naturally narcissistic when we get into amygdala hijack. But we actually, and this is not out of generosity, although I do advocate generosity, you're not thinking about the other person because it's good for them. You're thinking about the other person because it's good for you. Right? It helps you get unhooked from your interpretation of the story. And you, when you think about the other person, you want to think about, is this person an avoider or a seeker? What is motivating them here? Why are they doing what they're doing? And sure, you might think, well, he's acting that way because he's a jerk, and he always has been since the day I worked with him. So you want to come up with another explanation, and you want to be as generous as possible in that interpretation. I'm sure many of you work at organizations that have a value, assume positive intent, or something like that, right? And that is, you really need to do that when you're having difficult conversations. So what's going on for the other person? The second thing you need to do is think about, what are we actually disagreeing about? Because sometimes our first reaction is that we think we're having an interpersonal issue, that this is a relationship conflict. And often there are relationship conflicts at work where people are disrespecting one another. But more often than not, conflicts at work start as something else. And what we know from the research is that two of the most common types of work conflicts are over task, what are we trying to achieve, or process. How are we going to achieve it? And trust me, those are much easier to solve than to try to deal with your coworker's passive aggression. Right? So it's much better if you can figure out what is the core, what's the business issue here? Try not to take it personally. There is also a third type of conflict that's important to know about, also a little tricky to solve, and that's status conflict. So who actually gets to make the call here? But again, conflicts do not fall neatly into one of these four categories. Unfortunately, they're usually a hot mess of all four. But if you can discern what are the different threads and start with a task or a process, you then set the precedent, wow, we can agree on something. And that often helps to deal with the relationship or the status conflict. The third step before you even have the conversation, I know it's a lot of work we're doing here, right? The third thing is, what is your goal? Figure out, what is it I need from this conversation? And I am the first to admit that my goal very often is to prove that I am right and the other person is wrong, which is a terrible goal. But think about what do you actually need from this situation? Right? What is it? Do you need this project to come in on budget and get done on time? You need to have a strong relationship with this person because you're going to be collaborating with them closely for the coming year. Or do you need to just get this conversation over with and move on with your life? That goal will then help you determine how you're actually going to respond. And it's important to do those first three steps because sometimes the best response is to do absolutely nothing. And you just let it go. Now, that is not that. If you were one of those people who raised your hand for avoiding at the beginning, and you're like, oh, I love that option. I do nothing all the time. It works really well. No, it cannot be a default, right? It can't be what you do because you're afraid to have the conversation. It has to be because that's what's best for this particular conflict. Another caveat here: if you are going to do nothing, and then you go back to your desk, and you think about it for hours on end, and you find your work BFF, and you talk to their ear off about it, and then you go home, and you talk your partner's ear off about it, that's not doing nothing. That's doing a lot of stuff. So if you're going to do nothing, you have to truly let it go. Luckily, there are other options if do nothing is not the right option. You can address it directly. Sit down and hash it out. We're going to talk a lot about what that looks like today. You can also address it indirectly, where you involve a third party, not necessarily a mediator, but someone you both trust in the organization, someone who could maybe put in a good word for you. You can also use metaphors or stories to help resolve the conflict, especially if you're dealing with someone who's very conflict averse and is unable to address it directly. And then, of course, if you've tried one or hopefully all of those things and that doesn't work, your last option is to get out of the relationship. That's not always possible at work. You can't always get a new boss. You can't always get transferred to a new department. But there are ways to lessen the interaction. But that should be the last resort. Hopefully today we're going to give you skills and tools that are going to help you engage in conflict. Now, I joke with people, I'm like, I get to talk about my favorite topic today, conflict. And I do really love conflict. And I think conflict is quite underrated as a way of reaching positive outcomes at work. In fact, I think we need more conflict, not less. But we need to handle it with empathy, kindness, compassion, and we need to have productive, healthy conflicts. All right, let's meet these wonderful panelists. I'm going to have them each introduce themselves very briefly. You have their bios in your program if you want more information, and then we'll dig in with questions. As Giovanna said, we are going to leave 15 minutes at the end for questions. We'll let you know when it's time to line up at the mics to do that. We're looking forward to hearing from you. So, Gabby, we'll start with you and just go down the line if you can introduce yourselves.
Gabby Zetterveld, I'm the CMO of Affectiva. We're a local company, Boston-based. We spun out of MIT Media Lab. We're a software company that builds AI. We started the field of emotion AI, so technology that can analyze human face and voice to understand people's reactions, expressions, and emotions in context.
Good morning, everyone. I am Jeffrey Whitford. I'm the head of corporate responsibility and branding for MilliporeSigma, part of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
Hi, everyone. My name is Rachel Kosser. I used to dance professionally with the Boston Ballet, where I enjoyed a wonderful 10-year career. Retired about 3.5 years ago, so I try not to use the word retire, but it's just such a funny thing for me to use. I actually transitioned into a career in fundraising working at Harvard and realized within 2 months that there's actually a need to discuss our ability as humans to connect through the way that we express physically and nonverbally. I founded Choreography for Business about 2 years ago, and now I work training leaders, emerging leaders, and women in particular about the ways that we can really show up and connect and embody our intention.
So Rachel, we're going to start with you. Let's assume we're in a conflict, we decided we're going to address it. Before we have the conversation, what do we need to think about in terms of our body language?
Yeah, thank you, Amy. So, you know, it's a luxury, I think, to be in a situation where you are preparing for a conversation around a conflict, right? That gives you the opportunity to really pause, reflect on the goal, and then orient every aspect of your being around whatever your intention is in that conversation. From a physical body language perspective, there are a few things that we can do, and I'll share a couple of them. The very first one that I always start with is your posture, right? Ballet. But when you think about it, the way that you are, the way that your body aligns itself when you're sitting, when you're standing, when you're walking, those are all leading factors in the first impression. And the first impression is definitely something that comes to the front of our minds when we think of meeting someone for the first time. But when you also think about first impression, there's an opportunity to define how you come across to someone who you know very well on any given day, right? So-and-so looks really tired today. Oh, so-and-so's walking into my office, and I can tell that something's not quite right. Right? So if you're about to walk into someone's space and you have something on your mind and you want to talk about it and it's conflict-oriented, the way that you show up with your posture is very important, right? You want to make sure that you're not showing up in a way that is protective. And again, talking about that amygdala hijack, right? You don't want to be in that flight or fight position, right? Instead, you would probably want to have a sense of composure, confidence, and self-assurance, right? You're not necessarily here to fight. You're here to get to that end goal together, collaboratively. So to that end, I actually, if it's all right, I want to take just a second to give you an opportunity to embody and experience what I'm talking about. So I'm going to ask everyone to actually uncross your legs if they're crossed. And the thing that I talk about when I speak about posture, it's not actually just about this idea of like opening your chest, right? It starts from the ground and the connection that you have with the floor. As a dancer, the reason we can jump so high, turn so fast, move so quickly is because of the way that we relate to the floor. So I want you to close your eyes and actually place all of your energy and focused attention into the way that your feet are coming into contact with the ground. And I want you to actually actively, even ladies, if you're in heels, this is completely possible, through the four corners of your feet, right? So two corners of the, one where the big toe joint is, one where the baby toe joint is, and then one, let's just say, in the middle of the heel. Pretend that those are magnets and activate them by pressing against the ground. You'll see how there's almost this slight like lift in your whole body. I also then want you to take your attention to where your legs and your sits bones come into contact with the chair and do that same thing. Magnet and activate, press against that chair because that is a support system that is there for you. The rest of your body can actually almost just fall in an open structural position that should be quite comfortable, right? So it's actually amazing looking at you guys right now. There's this sense of presence from every one of you and then this collective energy that is incredibly powerful. Right? So you can shake it out but did you like raise your hand? Did you notice a difference between, you know, hanging out however you might comfortably and then almost charging with this energy into the ground? And that, number one, gives a sense of empowered presence, which is always helpful when you're about to walk into a situation where you have to think on your feet, right? And then it also reinforces for you this feeling of stability and support, right? The floor will not disappear, so you can always have that as a tool.
That's great.
Going forwards. Yeah.
I love that. Thank you. Gabby, as a woman in tech, I imagine showing up with that embodied presence is incredibly important, as often being the only woman in the room. To talk a little bit about how, when you are one of the few women, how conflict comes up and how you've been able to handle it.
Yeah, so it's interesting. And actually, I'm going to take a minute to do a quick audience thing as well. So raise your hand if you work in tech. Keep your hand up if you've been in tech for more than 10 years. Keep your hand up if you've been in tech for more than 20 years. Okay, so a few folks will know exactly what I'm talking about. So I've been in tech for about 25 years, and 25 years ago, it was scary. Like, I would go into meetings, and there would be 20 people in the room, and almost always I would know I would be the only woman there, especially if I was traveling abroad, Europe, the UK, Germany, Asia, especially if I would go to Japan. For those of you that have been in tech for as long as I have, we've seen things change, right? It's definitely gotten better. There's a lot more focus on diversity, not just gender, but age, ethnicity, people's cultural backgrounds and educational backgrounds. So we're experiencing more diversity, but the numbers are still really dismal, especially when you look at the leadership ranks, right? Still way too few women. Way too few women of color, way too few people that have off-the-beaten-track backgrounds. So I'm not surprised anymore these days. I almost expect it when I walk into a meeting, so I'm not as rattled anymore as it was in the past. But I have, over the years, really started noticing things that were quite interesting and figured out for myself how to handle it. And one thing that I'm sure many of you have experienced, especially if you're a woman, is that people can easily talk over you. Especially men have a tendency to do that. And it's not just with women. It's also dependent on where your ranking is in the organization. So if you're at the beginning of your career, also if you're a man and you're considered more junior, people will talk over you all the time. And I've learned, and I advise others to learn, to just not accept that. You're there in that meeting because you're a professional, because you have experiences and opinions that matter, because you can bring something to the table. If you don't, you should ask yourself why I'm in this meeting to begin with. But if you do, then don't allow people to talk over you. And there's many ways that you can handle that, and we can talk about that too, but there's with body language and your facial expressions and vocal approaches, there's ways that you can not allow for that to happen and just bring yourself to the table and have your opinions be heard. But most importantly, I think, is also watch out for others. And with my boss, our CEO, I certainly noticed that she does that. To this day, there'll be meetings with groups of people, and people might talk over me. She and I now have worked together for about 5 years, so we have a good rapport. I might just look at her and raise my eyebrow, as in, like, did that just really happen? I'm not saying it, but I'll just be like, did someone just talk over me? And sometimes I'll interject myself, but you don't always want to be the nag in the room either. So she's very good about calling it out. She'll stop the meeting. She's like, oh, hold on a second before we move on. Gabby, what did you want to say? And I've learned to do that with others as well, with my peers, with the people that report to me, with other folks on the team. Be mindful of the fact that they can get talked over and don't allow it. Give them a voice at the table.
Jeffrey, you've mentioned to me that you often are in a similar situation because you come off as quite young. And I'm curious what conflict has been like, or, you know, being talked over for you has been like in such a large organization where you have a job that requires you deliver bad news and you negotiate with quite a few different stakeholders.
Yeah, I think we all bring different things to the table. So we all struggle with different scenarios when we're going into these situations. And it's learning how to navigate and kind of bolster the things to mitigate the things that you recognize. So if there's patterns that you're seeing, how do you quickly identify them and then build strategies then to work to mitigate the negative effect or what you're experiencing? Knock on wood, I use a lot of sunscreen. So I've mitigated some wrinkling, but I am 38, and in the organization that I work in, what I've been doing in corporate responsibility, I've been doing for about a decade. And it's really interesting because as a 28-year-old, saying this is the strategy that we as a global company should use, and then also being recognized by the global at Davos for the work that we were doing, those two points don't really necessarily connect. You would think somebody more senior would do that. But we're really fortunate to have a team of really great people. But you learn very quickly, I think, how you can use things like data. That became one weapon for me. I knew my content inside and out. And I could use that data because people kind of perked up. They were like, this isn't just kind of, you know, some magic happening. There's actually some content here. And that brings something completely different to the conversation when you come with something that people don't expect, when you can disarm people in a way that they're not expecting. I find that to be one of the best kind of tips or tricks that I can use in those situations to mitigate those conflicts, to really reinforce my position and what I'm talking about is to have something that is really backed in data and fact that they can, you know, connect with.
Yeah. I think focusing on the content is such a great piece of advice because so often we tell ourselves stories, to use Brené Brown's language, right? We tell ourselves stories when someone reacts to how we're presenting, or there's a conflict or something tense comes up in a meeting, is that we often get so fixated on what's that reaction mean? What do they think about us? Instead of focusing on the underlying issue. And I think sometimes just focusing on the business content can be a way to sort of, as you say, disarm them and get into the conversation. I want to get quite practical here because I know everyone is looking for practical tips. And I'm curious if, you know, particularly Rachel, if you could talk a little bit about what are ways, you gave us that great exercise to sort of for embodied presence, what are ways to really change the way we show up in a conversation, in a difficult conversation in particular, change our body language habits?
Yeah, so speaking about habits, and you know, this goes back to starting with posture, but it's this question of awareness of yourself and the way that your body reacts to stress and pressure, right? So we all do react in very different ways. Some of us, again, are geared into this fight position, and so all of a sudden we will get very aggressive, right? We will square off with our quote-unquote opponent. I know that's not necessarily the right word for this person that you're trying to work with, but that in our minds is we're about to fight, right? So if that's your reaction, then you're going to have to actually, again, and I always say, like, that excess energy, the floor is there to absorb it, so you can press that into the ground and become maybe taller and wider without becoming more aggressive in that sense. If you're the type of person who's actually, you know, shrinks into themselves and tries to almost apologetically take up less space, right? That's when you have to actually start to, again, using the pressure and starting everything from the ground, really fill out your whole width. One thing that you mentioned that I think is interesting is this question of when someone reacts to something that you say or something that you do, and then you immediately start to figure out what that means, right? A lot of those reactions are happening from a nonverbal perspective, right? Maybe you said something and someone leaned away and maybe even crossed their arms, right? One thing that I always share when I'm speaking about body language is that these nonverbal cues that we're picking up on all the time, most often from a subconscious level, are not there for us to judge quickly and say, oh, that person must be lying because they touched their nose, right? It's information. They are tools for you to pick up on if you're aware of them, to then start asking different questions or maybe pivoting your conversation based on how they're reacting to you. So if you say something and you notice that someone actually tilts their head a little bit and leans in, you know you're on a positive track. Those are positive nonverbal cues. If someone crosses their arms at the time that you say one specific thing, you might want to dig a little deeper on that, right? Because they might be nodding their head but crossing their arms. Those are two conflicting nonverbal cues, and so you're going to want to continue your questioning so that you know that their yes is truly affirmative and not, you know, a maybe.
Jeffrey, you recently had an experience where you had multiple conflicts in 1 week. Tell us a little bit about what happened and how you navigated those.
I mean, I don't know about you guys. I feel like some days I'm playing a game of like conflict whack-a-mole, and they are popping up everywhere. You're just trying to survive. I think it was actually probably one of the toughest weeks in my career. And you know, I've gone through some things, and it was interesting to me because I think one thing that, and we talk about this conversation and the reaction is, I joke that my work is kind of like my work child, and it is very personal. And so the reactions that you have in these situations change dramatically when you are really connected to what you're doing. And I've had a couple of follow-up conversations. So right now I'm doing two jobs in two different businesses with both of my bosses about this experience. You know, we had some data that didn't go a positive way for us in a cancer study, and we needed to put out negative news. And man, it went sideways on me. And I am a person who's usually quite on top of things. And the emails didn't go out how they were supposed to. We didn't get pre-informs out. And I just was like, what is happening and how am I failing this miserably? And my boss was sick at that time. And so that adds more things to the sauce. And that's when you take back and you step back and you realize being able to think about all the different factors that go into these decisions and having the presence, as Amy was talking about, to step back. And I think it's extremely difficult. This is one thing I struggle with, is stepping back quick enough in that moment to realize and take that moment to say, think about where all these things are coming from. This isn't about you. There are all these other factors. On top of that, we had an incident in one of our locations where one of our employees had a gun held to their head while doing a volunteer activity.
Wow.
Never something you would think about. They are going to read to children. That's the core. Like I started my job, I say how I started my job was I volunteered into it in corporate responsibility. And I have spent the better part now of 15 years building a global volunteer program that all of our employees can take advantage of. And you see that moment get threatened and hang in the balance. And how do you respond to that? And, you know, I was so fortunate to have a boss who is so kind and compassionate. And she really talked me off multiple ledges and said, Jeffrey, you know, an email went out internally about something and it was not flattering. And she said, Jeffrey, you need to remember you've built a reputation and people know where you're coming from and your intent. And I think that point that you're talking about is people's intent is such an important thing. You know, Brene Brown said this yesterday, and I told my friend, I was like, I feel kind of vindicated. Like, I want a trachea punch a lot of people a lot of times. I don't. I've not done that. But in those moments, when the responses, and you get so personal with this, to have somebody who is there, and so the strategy or practical thing is find that outlet who is going to be able to give you that reprieve or the pressure valve to take out. Because for me, it was a lifesaver. You know, like, I think this might have been the first time I cried at work on the phone with my boss. And she was amazing. She was just so great to help me through that and then figure out how are we going to transition out of this and what is the solution to fix the issue. And that's the ultimate thing. Amy and I said that, we said this, is every moment you spend in the conflict is one less moment you can spend in the resolution. And I think that, to me, is so important.
Yeah, I'm really focusing on the future. Because you can spend a lot of time, I'm sure many of you have done this, where you just rehash the conflict over and over, right? What happened? No, no, you said this, that meant this, right? But really focusing, okay, what is the resolution? What are we going to do differently going forward? And I love the point you're making, Jeffrey, about personal. I know we all feel very passionately about our jobs. I'm sure you all feel passionately about our jobs. But that doesn't mean you have to take conflict personally. There's a difference between being passionate at your job and treating it like your entire identity revolves around it. And I also felt quite vindicated by Brene, because I also want to punch people in the face multiple times a day. But I think it's because, and I'm a conflict expert, right? But it's the important thing is to feel that emotion. You're allowed to have that reaction. You just don't do it, right? You just don't do it, and you find your better self and react from there, partly through body language, partly through reminding yourself that you have value and worth and focusing on the business content.
Yeah, and I was just thinking as you were speaking, so many of our communications in work context are all either email or Slack these days, right? And it's so easy to misinterpret intent,
absolutely,
misread. Even you might think you're writing an articulate email and it doesn't come across that way at all. And there really is nothing wrong with walking over to someone and having a chat or picking up the phone. Like, we use Slack so much, and that was maybe a year ago, the Slack servers were down, and we were at the time in an open office space. Suddenly it was loud, because people now had to talk to each other rather than Slack the person that was sitting across from them, right? But also on the flip side of that, because so many communications are, let's say, in email or Slack, it is so easy to hyper-react so quickly. And I have learned, and of course I make mistakes on a daily basis and I don't always handle this well, but I have learned to really sleep on it sometimes. I remember many years ago there was a very strange situation with a very narcissistic CEO who said really weird and bizarre things in a company meeting that were completely unempathetic. And I got home and was really offended by it. And I sat down and I just wrote it down. And I was like, okay, I'm going to send that to the CEO. I'm going to send that to the company that's about to come in and buy us, and the people that are doing due diligence, and my management, and I'm about to go on maternity leave. So let me just sleep on it. And then the next morning, of course, I woke up at 6 a.m., like, completely revved up. I had my cup of coffee, and I sat down, and I read the email. And in that instance, I actually realized, you know what? That's exactly to the point. It was articulate. What I wrote was right. And you know what? Send.
Wow.
But there's been other occasions where I would do the same thing, and I'm like, I slept on it. I'm like, why did I even get worked up about this? Whatever, let it go.
Yeah. And I think there's an exercise to help give you perspective that I often recommend, which is that ask yourself, how am I going to feel about this tomorrow?
Yes.
How am I going to feel about this next week?
and how will I feel about this in a year?
That's a good one.
And because it gives you the, you don't have the perspective in the moment. You think it's so important and so critical. And we all, I can guarantee all of you have email inboxes that are overloaded, calendars that are packed. We all feel under the sense of urgency. And it makes us do things like send an email we regret, you know, not be careful in our Slack messages, right? So much of the conflict that I deal with inside organizations is just about simply miscommunication and tone. And it really, it just helps to be assume positive intent, but also to be careful about what we say and consider consider other people.
And sometimes doing nothing is totally okay and probably the best option.
Yes, sometimes.
Not intuitive.
No. And you also can't be a doormat, right? You also cannot just let. And I think that's one thing I'd love to talk about, because conflicts come up, and sometimes we, especially women, we know from research, we have there's a lot of pressure on us to appease, to be likable. And I'm curious, just from our parents here, and Rachel, we can start with you. How do you make sure that you are not just acquiescing in a conflict and instead actually standing your ground, literally, perhaps?
Right. So it's interesting. I just piggybacking on what Gabby said about actually standing up, and if there is an opportunity to go and speak your email or speak your communication, I think because of the way that we gather context from nonverbal perspective, the more information you have from where someone else might be coming from and then where you might be able to clarify any potential miscommunication because of the way you're showing up, I think is always helpful. In terms of making sure that you're standing your ground from a nonverbal perspective, it's pretty simple, right? I mean, you want to have that anchor within yourself that physically is something that never has to go away, right? So again, it's making sure that you're grounded. It's making sure that your hands, right? These are basically the windows into your soul, right? We're very expressive with our hands as human beings. We use our hands to give us access to our whole world around us. Try not to be doing little fidgety things, right? Fixing our hair, tugging on a shirt collar, right? These are all pacifying movements which can provide the signal, again, subconsciously to the other person. It's not like they're like, oh, well, that person's, you know, rubbing their shoulder, that means X. Like, that's not really going to happen. But what might happen is that people will pick up on a discomfort in you, and if they're so inclined, take advantage of that, right? You want to show, again, that sense of composure and confidence and ownership, command. And those are all things that will happen if you're very open with the way that you present yourself. You're using more palms up gestures, but if you need to be authoritative, it's palms down, right? If I'm speaking to you like this, I'm not hiding anything, right? Hands free, open, authentic. But if I really need you to take something home, it's palms down. This is more forceful. So those are just a few little tactics that you can employ to make sure that you're not being taken advantage of from a nonverbal perspective.
Jeffrey, how about you? In a difficult conversation, how do you make sure that you're heard?
It's interesting. So I currently live and work in Germany, and there are definitely cultural differences. And I think that's one thing is whether it is country of origin or just even where you are from or what you bring to the table, those differences bring some interesting kind of ingredients to things. I recently was told my feedback was too harsh, which is interesting because Germany is
coming from Germans.
The land of some mallet feedback. You know, it is it's pretty blunt. And I was taken back, but I think this is the interesting thing about culture and how that plays into this conversation. People expect me as an American to give American-style feedback. Now, according to my cultural test that I took when I moved, I'm like right in the middle between America and Germany. So I was leaning in hard to the German side. But it goes back to that understanding the context of the conversation, because that definitely wasn't, like, that's not my intent. It was like to come off as like a harsh American. It was really trying to move in this direction, and I think that's where being heard in that conversation is also understanding and navigating all of these kind of cues, you know, as Rachel was talking about. The thing that I have now found in terms of how to make sure that I'm heard is that I make sure I'm listening and make sure that the other person feels like they don't have to spend their time getting the point across that they're trying to make because they feel like I'm not listening to them. Because that, to me, is that counterpoint where we can get to a resolution when we both feel that we've been heard and that we've been listened to. And so I think that, for me, is one of the most powerful things.
Yeah, Harvard Negotiation Project has a great piece of advice, which is the best way, and this is based on research, is that the best way to persuade someone to change their mind is to show them that you are able to change your mind. Right, and really, sometimes I even encourage people to model that in a difficult conversation to say, you know what, I see your point. I feel differently about this now. If you genuinely do, I do not ever advocate for lying, because that gives them the permission that it's okay for them to do the same.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. Also, what you were saying just very much resonates with me. I think especially in tech, right, we're constantly surrounded by Type A personalities, and I'm certainly one of them. And not only that, because I've been around the blocks so many times, you get a little bit jaded too, right? So when there's conflict or challenging situations, I'll be sitting there thinking to myself, oh, I've been in that rodeo before, and I know what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. So maybe my idea for a resolution or an approach might eventually be the right one, but that's not always the right way to handle the situation. So sitting back and listening doesn't always come easy to me, but is incredibly important, and also give other people an opportunity to come with a suggestion or a plan for resolution. And again, I might be sitting there thinking, okay, well, I don't think that's going to go anywhere, but don't articulate that, and think it through with those people. And then maybe, and this is where you have to be open to changing your own mind and your opinion, maybe there is actually a great other approach or another idea, because rarely is it linear, right? There's different ways you can come to resolution. And then you have to be willing and also willing to say, okay, actually, I didn't think of that option. It's a great idea. Let's do that. Or work with people to get to that point where you have a better resolution that might have been your idea in the first place. But I think it's really key to sit back and listen, and especially for folks that are, you know, more of the conflict engagers and more reactive in nature, as I am myself, that's not always easy. So often I'll just be in meetings that get heated, and I'll just be like, okay, just wait, listen, wait, and not immediately react.
Yeah. And Jeffrey, what you were saying about people expecting you to be American in a German context, that's very parallel with what we know about the gender research around conflict, which is that we expect women to be collective, care about the group, right? So when they assert themselves, whether it's negotiating a salary, expressing opinion, they tend to incur more social penalty. And I'm curious if you all have any suggestion that it's exhausting mental gymnastics to have to think about, well, they expect me to be likable and to care about the collective, so how can I navigate this conversation? But I'm curious if you all have any tips for how to both be assert yourself while also caring about the group dynamic.
Yeah, and I think you said it earlier as well, data. Come with the facts, come prepared, come with knowledge, come with data, and have a compelling argument. Especially in challenging work situations or conflict situations, if it's all based on emotion and assumptions, that's not really helpful. But if you can just very calmly lay out the data, lay out the facts, that really helps, I've experienced.
I think being who you are authentically is important. And I think, you know, I say this as a male, so I understand the irony of this. But I don't feel like you should have to, as a female, like, lose those aspects of, like, if emotion is who you are, be that person.
Yeah.
That is just fine. Now, can you supplement it, as Gabby was saying, with the data, right? And you make an interesting combination there. So I think that's the thing, is when you are able to come at that with who you are, and then, once again, it's figuring out and bolstering those things with other components. But at the end of the day, when it is about whatever the topic is at hand, you would be able to hopefully, even if there's another way and you can see that, you know, parallel thinking, you should be able to come to the resolution if there's a willingness to show up, to listen, and then to adjust or make changes accordingly, if it's, as you said, if it's should be done, you know, otherwise. But I fully support being who you are, and if that includes emotion or, you know, the things that people expect of you, like, go for it.
That's, I just want to add real quick, that's so important, I think, being your authentic self, because that builds trust and builds relationships with your coworkers. Because if you put on a facade or a fake you, eventually people will see through that, and I don't think it really helps.
Yeah, I think just kind of bringing everything that you've all said, whether knowing your content, bringing your knowledge and expertise to the table, and in the way that you deliver it, being articulate and crisp, things like those filler words are essentially taking away from your message. They can be considered nonverbals because they're not carrying very much meaning. But if you can take those away, then you're left with your message. You're able to have your message land in the way that you intend for it to, the way that you use eye contact, right? All of those things can help make sure that your expertise is really backed up by the delivery.
Yeah. I think we could talk about this topic for like 3 more hours. But we want to hear from you. So I'm going to invite Giovanna back up. We are going to take some questions. I think if you would have a question, there's mics in the aisles. You can start lining up, and Giovanna will let you know.
Yeah. As you guys line up, I'm going to ask a quick question of each of you with all those wonderful nuggets of information that you just gave us. That was really great. Some of it is definitely work that needs to be done. Every minute spent in the conflict, you aren't spending in your resolution and sleep on it. But all these women in this room and men, do you have a nugget of information, an action item, a marching order, or something that they could leave this room today and do easily as that low-hanging fruit?
Yeah, my best piece of advice is start the conversation with a question. Ask the other person something you genuinely don't know. And I'll tell you, my husband and I were once doing this exercise. I'm going to swear because Brene Brown did. My husband and I once were doing this couples exercise where we're supposed to ask each other a curious question. He said, "I'm curious why you're being an asshole." So that doesn't qualify as a question. That was actually a statement. But that is my piece of advice. And ask the person a question, because it shows that you're willing to collaborate in reaching a resolution. And it also gives you critical information as you're trying to get to a resolution.
That's really good. So I think we've given great little nuggets of how we handle things. But I'll be the first to admit, sometimes that just goes wrong, right? Like, we've all been in situations where there's conflict and you just lose it. Or maybe you just snap or say something unfriendly. My takeaway would be is just apologize right there and then. You know, we're all human. We all make mistakes. I've had experiences even recently where I was in a meeting and someone who was a bit more junior than me said something that I thought was stupid, frankly. And I didn't quite say that, but I snapped at the person. And people kind of looked up like, what was that all about? And I realized there and then, oh my God, I totally shouldn't have done that. I actually ended up apologizing. I sought out the person, went straight up to him and said, "I apologize, I should not have done that. That was unprofessional and not fair to you, so I apologize." And even then, kind of preempting what would come, went to that person's manager and apologized. Well, kind of explained that I apologized. And all's good, it created respect. Everyone understands that happens. But just keep that in the back of your mind. You will all... you've done it, you will all do it again, but just apologize.
I think because a lot of our communication is digital, I would say put your phone down, put your computer away, and do not send. Just do not do it. Take a breath on it.
Yeah. Love that. I think I would challenge everyone to really become aware of how you show up when you're not necessarily paying attention to your body language, and then asking the question, is that serving you? I think many of you might find that you tend to adopt closed or aggressive postures when that's not what you're intending. And being able to first be aware then allows you to make different choices and layer it.
Thank you. Let's start over here to our left.
I wanted to follow up on a couple of the recent comments. I've seen patterns of behavior where if a position is advocated passionately or emotionally, especially if it conflicts with other opinions or higher ranking opinions, so to speak, it can be dismissed based on the method of delivery, regardless of the content. And I'd be interested in views of the panel on the use of passion and emotion in addressing conflict.
I'm happy to answer that. So I think that one of the keys is that you have to read your room. Yeah. There are times that passion, enthusiasm, even getting angry or upset. I actually have a coworker who was incredibly frustrated with someone they worked with and was doing everything they could to make it go well. And she finally lost it one day. And he said, "Oh, I didn't know you felt that way." Right? And he just was not reading all of the cues until she got angry. And so there is a time and a place for emotion, but the key is you have to be in control of that emotion, and you have to choose to use that emotion. So this group needs to know how passionate I am about this project, that I feel that I'm very emotional about it. But you have to know that they're going to be receptive to that. So really, this is where your audience is key. And if you don't know your audience, find someone who does, someone who's presented to them before what works well, what doesn't. You have to, of course, be yourself as well, but you want to modulate that a little bit for who you're talking to. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think generally I'm someone who doesn't get very angry in situations, but I reserve that in my back pocket, right? I do know that given the context, the situation in the room, who's in the room, what's the topic, sometimes you just really have to get angry, but selectively.
Great. Let's take this one right here.
Thank you all for being here. It's nice hearing from all of you. I'm the director of operations for a small television software company. I'm the only woman on the small team. I also work remotely, mm-hmm. but I've worked in my role for 12 years, so I am established. I would like to know, how do you deal with conflict when you only have email or phone, when you don't have that mm-hmm. interaction? When I do go out to Los Angeles and meet with people, it's so much easier. But I deal with a lot of high-maintenance people, a lot of difficult people, who want to argue all the time, and how is it best to handle that when you only have the phone and email?
So, I'm caveating this. My boss is in the room. so I am not saying you are any of those things. High maintenance. Video conference is the best thing. I am now pushing to do that with a majority of my meetings, because it gives you another dynamic, and it goes back to what Amy was talking about, that emotional intelligence component, to at least give you some more factors to be able to just pulse check on in terms of how those things are going. There are a ton of free video conferencing services that you can mm-hmm. tap into, but I think, like for me and my boss, when we do one-on-ones, it is like the best thing. Like we've said, okay, we're not gonna do these in the car, we're not gonna we're gonna be in on video where we can look at each other, because we're just able to be much more effective. Like you said, it's easier.
Right.
We are just so much stronger when we do that way, and the outcome's so much better.
If you have a client who likes to hide behind email.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. That.
People yep. do that all the time, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, two tips from research, one of which is you have to over-communicate. If you're only communicating in email, you have to communicate a lot of what you would communicate non-verbally, mm-hmm. literally, right? So I don't mean my tone to be frustrated. I know this project is stressful, right? Like, communicate what is the tone of the email, because people can't read tone from text. The other piece of research, there's a wonderful woman named Pam Hines. If any of you work remotely, I highly recommend you look her up. She's at Stanford. She does a lot about globally dispersed teams. And she talks about having a shared context. So the reason we give the person who is in the office down the hall the benefit of the doubt is because we have a shared context. We both use the same restroom. We both know what the weather's like where we are, right? We both use the same systems.
So in that, what you need to do as much as possible, especially with people you're working with regularly, is increase your understanding of their context. So that might mean video conference. That might mean visiting their site. It might mean being chatting about the weather for 5 minutes before you dig into the business, even if it's on email. Right, something that actually sets the context so that you have a shared understanding going into the conversation. Okay. Thanks for
thank you.
Over here to our right. Yes, hi. Thank you so much for the tips and words of wisdom. I think it's very useful. I work in financial technology. I'm a product manager for Charles River Development. So I felt that what Gabby has said has a lot of relevance to me. I work with mostly men, and we're owned by State Street now. And actually, there's a lot of men there in leadership as well. I'm wondering, I am the kind of woman that I talk more like a man. So I bring facts to the table. I'm an engineer from MIT. And I can be forceful sometimes. I'm not very emotional. And I think it's hard sometimes for men to understand that we should be treated equally. I find that when I'm very forceful with my argument, not necessarily forceful, but have a conviction, the same kind of conviction, and talking in a confident way, sometimes it can a little bit like set men already on a defensive tone, and I wonder how do you deal with that so you can start at a level playing field?
An answer for that one?
That is a really good question. I'm not sure if I've figured that one out in time. I think I keep coming back to the facts and data, right? Just especially in product management, and I was a product manager for many years. Just come prepared. Come with the facts. And I think also what is really important, and I think as a product manager you have a lot of opportunities, show people that you can deliver, you know, that you're true to your word. If you take on a project or a deliverable, make sure that you know what you commit to, and then myopically focus on execution and deliver. Because if you are someone who makes things happen and you deliver your products or your capabilities on time, you will garner respect and be treated as an equal. And I don't necessarily think it's a gender thing. I think it's more an ego thing. Because in tech we have too many egos, especially on the product development side.
One other thing I've learned myself is that sometimes I have an interaction with someone where I feel they're underestimating me, and I get into that mode where I'm like, this is never going to work.
Yeah. Right?
I catastrophize the situation. And sometimes what I have to do is just remind myself this dynamic will probably change. When they see that I understand my stuff, when they see that I'm able to communicate, that this dynamic may change. And sometimes just not, because I think the tension of, ugh, I don't like this person, all that makes it worse. And so if I can just tell myself, this is what it is right now, hopefully it'll change once they get over their ego and see I have something to contribute.
And that's a really good point. Yeah.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you. We only have time for one more question.
Ooh, make it good then.
Yeah.
One thing I was going to say is I recently got a tidbit, which is put a delay on your email. So write the email, you hit send, and then you say 1 minute or a 2 minute delay. And in case you forgot something and you said, okay, regret or whatever, you would take it back. So you have time in that period of time. And it's worked for me. One thing is we were talking about a person that we work with that is difficult in meetings. He tends to roll his eyes every time he hears something that doesn't go with the way he wants to go, he agrees with or whatever. And basically changes the tone of the whole meeting. And people basically start disregarding this person, and you kind of get, either you get annoyed at him, or you discount that person's opinion right off the bat. So how do you deal with somebody like that? I was told to deal directly with the person, but if it's your boss, how do you deal with that?
An eye-rolling boss, that's a fun one. Oh. Yeah. Have you all dealt with eye-rolling?
Well, I was going to say, you should probably send your boss to me and... I can help him out with some gentle feedback.
Yeah. I do think there's if you are in a position to give that person direct feedback, it would be enormously helpful to everyone, including yourself. if you are not, if that would risk your job, I understand. Maybe you can get that feedback to someone who is able to give it to that person. That person may not even know. I know people who've rolled their eyes and they don't even mean to roll their eyes. It's just become a habit from an ego defensiveness, right? And you look smart if you roll your eyes. You actually look like an asshole, but you also think you look smart. So I think it's if that person needs that feedback as much as possible, and I think you also want to just really I'm getting the like hook here. So I'll very quickly just say I think you also want to make sure as a team that you talk about how will you react when that happens so it does not derail a productive conversation.
That's a good point.
All right. Thank you all so much.
Thank you to our panelists. Amy will be signing copies of her book in the exhibit hall, and check the app because this will be recorded and you'll be able to see this or hear it again in a week.